If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, September the 17th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. My guest today in our studio here in Hoover's Washington, D.C. office, just a couple of blocks from the White House, is Charles Hurt. Charles Hurt is the opinion editor and columnist for the Washington Times. He's also a Fox News contributor. If you watch that channel, you'll recognize him and his voice. You'll see him often on Brett Baer's special report. Charlie Hurt started out as a beat reporter for the Detroit News and Washington correspondent for the Charlotte Observer. He was D.C. bureau chief and Washington House correspondent, White House correspondent for the New York Post and editor at the Drudge Report. You've been everywhere, haven't you? He is also the author of a book that came out earlier this summer, and that's our focus of the podcast today. The book's title, Still Winning, Why America Went All In on Donald Trump and Why We Must Do It Again. Let's sell some books today, Charlie.
Sounds good, Bill. Thanks for having me.
So, first thing I noticed about your book was that you held your book party at the Tune Inn.
The Tune Inn. I bet you've been to the Tune Inn.
I've been to the Tune Inn. So I grew up in this town. I've been to the Tune Inn. And for those who are not familiar with the Tune Inn, it is a burger and beer joint on the House side of Capitol Hill. And I think you did that on purpose because that sounds absolutely Trumpian.
Yes, it is. I definitely did it on purpose. And I think you can still get a cold Budweiser in a bottle for, you know, $2.25. It's a little bit more than what you get in the real world, but for Washington, D.C., that's not bad.
Two things about the Tune Inn that stand out to me, Charlie. One is it's a fascinating study of life on Capitol Hill. You will go in there in the evenings, and you will find a booth full of young women, usually with one older man. And he's not trying to do something bad to the women. He just wants to be young and hip himself. And so he's there feeling young with them, but he's there for one reason.
Yeah.
He's going to buy.
Yeah, that's right. And the walls are festooned with taxidermied animals, mm-hmm. which I also love. And there are a number of firearms hanging on the walls in there. And every time I look up and I see them, I just think, do they know that they're sitting in here? Because I can you imagine Beto O'Rourke if he knew that there was a bar on Capitol Hill that had guns hanging on the walls?
He'd grab them and run.
That's right.
So actually, I had a buddy who worked in the Clinton and the Carter White House. I'm dating myself here, but he worked in the Carter White House, and he used to go to the Tune Inn. And back in the 70s, there was a waitress at the Tune Inn named Berta. And she was just a force of nature. And when my buddy got to the White House, he jokingly said one day, why don't you come down and have lunch with us? So sure enough, a few days later, she pulls in her car to the White House. It's the 70s, a kinder, gentler time. You can't pull a car in the White House now. And she goes up the White House gate in the car and said, may I help you? He goes, yeah, I'm Berta. I'm here for lunch. You most certainly are. Come on in.
That's great. Those were the days when you could still drive on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of Lafayette Park, which, of course, is all closed now.
Let's talk about the book. Corey Lewandowski said that you were maybe the first reporter to get it when it came to Donald Trump. Get it, meaning that this guy is not just putting on a show, but he's connecting with people. What did you see with Trump back in 2015 that caught your attention?
Well, the first thing was, you know, he speaks so differently than politicians. It's not this scrubbed down, you know, politically correct language. And some of the stuff that causes reporters to cringe the most, such as when he talked about illegal immigrants coming, or illegal aliens rather, coming over the border and committing crimes in this country. You know, people were, you know, in the news business are cringing, or in the political business are cringing, because it's just not the way you politicians talk about this stuff.
Right.
And the fact that Trump was willing to go out there and talk about those things, those are issues that matter to. It's not racist. They are issues that matter to people. And quite frankly, if we're going to break it down, break America down by racial groups, and we're going to talk about Hispanics versus non-Hispanics. A lot of those issues matter more to Hispanics because a lot of those crimes occur in those areas. And so this knee-jerk reaction from politically correct people to say, oh, well, he's racist or he's insensitive, that doesn't ring true with regular, normal people, even regular, normal, hardworking Hispanics who are Americans. They just think that he's actually talking about an issue that they care about. And then of course, you know, the disconnect between the way people in Washington talked about Trump after he announced and the way regular people that you just know in your normal life I live 4 hours south of here in a small tobacco town. The way people would talk about him there, and the amount that they would talk about him, you would never get people in a little bar in my town talking about a debate right. in a primary, ever. But after the first debate, I can't remember where it was.
Cleveland.
In Cleveland.
Right, the Megyn Kelly debate.
Yes, that one. After that debate, you walk into the bar in my hometown, and everybody in there was talking, did you hear what he said? Did this? And people, he engaged those people.
But at what point, Charlie, did you come to the conclusion? Was it how far before Iowa was it that you came to the conclusion that, okay, people, they listen to him, they're intrigued by him, they'll watch him on TV, but they'll actually vote for him? When did you come to the conclusion he could actually garner votes?
Well, I'll tell you this, Bill. Literally, it's funny, and I recount this in
and I ask this because part of the whole 2016 was I'm guilty of this. I don't know how many of your colleagues are. We all thought, okay, this will last for a while.
Right.
At some point, he's going to be shown the door.
Right. And I don't know. And I really do think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that I go to great lengths to step away from this place.
Right.
And literally, I live 4 hours south of here. I have a room here where I come up and stay. And I do my best to sort of stay grounded in the sort of regular people. The day, and I go into this in the book, the day that Donald Trump announced on, I think it was June 15th, 2015, and I had already filed my column for the day. It was a Wednesday, or a Tuesday for Wednesday's paper. And literally, I walked into the other room of my office, and I'm just sitting, and he comes down the glass elevator, and he delivers his speech. And I literally called up it was like in the movies, I called up the newspaper and I was like, hold the presses, kill the column, I'm sending another one. And I had never endorsed a politician for president in my life, but I endorsed him that day. But I'll say that, and he called me the next day, as he is wont to do, because he does like people who like him. Shocking to find a politician who likes people who like him. But I was always very wary. Because I wasn't 100% sure, I thought that there was a chance that he could be faking it and that he didn't really mean what he was saying. And so, I would get invited to go up and see him. And I never wanted a picture of me and him doing this. And so I never, I didn't go to Mar-a-Lago. I didn't do any of that stuff because I wanted to maintain my credibility to just torch him when he turned on people. And turned on the people that I care about, which are the people he was talking to. And he never did. At what moment? I mean, I never doubted that he could win. But I also was very sober about the forces that were arrayed against him that wanted to destroy him. And it wasn't just the Democrats. It was plenty of Republicans, even after he got the nomination. Plenty of Republicans, plenty of conservative, media types out to destroy him. So I felt confident that he could win, but it was still sort of amazing to go through that election night.
Charlie, if we were to get a boat and fill it with journalists who are in for Trump in 2020, who support Trump, who you think would vote for Trump or sympathize to Trump, how big of a boat do we need? The old Jaws line, we're gonna need a bigger boat. Do we need a canoe? Do we need a rowboat? Do we need a cruise ship? How big of a boat do we need to go with here?
It's funny. I mean, are you talking about people who claim to be in favor of him or people who are actually?
Put it this way. If we were to fill up a boat with journalists who don't like Donald Trump, would like to see him go away, probably need an aircraft carrier
You would need the biggest boat right. There is. Just look at this Kavanaugh stuff that is coming out, a year after he was confirmed to the Supreme Court, based on complete nonsense and, made-up testimonies that weren't remembered in the first place and weren't even testified by actual people.
I think
people.
You have a hunch as to what that's all about.
Of course. Of course.
They're selling books. The book is out today, isn't it?
There's definitely – that is definitely going on. But there is something else going on here too.
They hate Donald Trump.
It's that – yes. Yeah. It's that and they hate it's not that they hate misogynists. They hate Brett Kavanaugh because of what he represents. But it's still it's that lateral attack where, oh, we're going to talk about a book, and it's going to be over here in this section of the newspaper, and it's going to be planted over here where politics doesn't exist, but it's going to be a laser shot right at this guy. And it's really pernicious and dishonest. And no one, the New York Times, the New York Times has their story. And then the Washington Post comes up with their headline today: "Inaction on Kavanaugh Allegations Reignites Political Rancor." It wasn't inaction on Kavanaugh allegations that reignited it. It was a made-up story that appeared in the paper, and it's a terrible time for anyone who wants to have a media that they can trust and have a place they can go. And
this episode kind of shows the worst of all things. It shows the worst in terms of media treatment. It shows the worst in terms of presidential candidates, because look how many Democratic hopefuls immediately jumped on this story and called for the removal of Kavanaugh.
Do you think a single one of them will ever apologize for that?
No, of course not. This? And there's a congresswoman from Massachusetts who could introduce an impeachment resolution next week. So everybody gets a bite out of this.
And it's all just so dishonest. And part of the thing, going back to Trump, that I do believe that at a much lower volume and in a much sneakier way, this has been going on with the quote-unquote mainstream media for a long time. And so I like it that Trump fights these people and goes toe-to-toe with them. You know, obviously it you wind up with a lot of unnecessary fights or unnecessary, he gets into perhaps some unnecessary stuff by doing it all the time. But I'll take that if the alternative is him not beating him up.
I'd like to read you a passage in your book, Charlie, because I think this gets to the heart of the matter here. Let me read. Quote, "Throughout Donald J. Trump's short triumph in political career, he has been truly blessed with the greatest gift every politician prays for: terrible opponents. Whether it's Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton, Trump's opponents have been, to use a favorite term of Trump's, real beauties. Looking towards 2020, those beauties get more and more beautiful every day. He's looking at everything from fake Indians to fired porn star lawyers to open border fanatics. The most sensible among them are full-blown socialists. If Donald Trump's 2016 election was the barbarian storming the gates of Washington, this Democratic field looks more like the lunatics trying to take over the asylum. Trump can barely conceal his glee over the opportunity to face such a bunch in the election. Quote, we have 350 million people living in America, and this is the best we can do, he asks, smiling.
He definitely has a way with his humor. And it's amazing how many people in Washington don't get it. But, I mean, you look at that, and you look at the field, and you look at, you know, to me, the person that is in the lane, as we talk about it, that is most, I think, most likely to win and most likely to appeal to most Democrat voters is Joe Biden, who is, in fact, the number one in the polls, and I think will be for a long time, until somebody comes along and replaces him, because obviously the things that he's saying, and then he's also trying to play footsie with the crazy left of his party in order to sink some of his Democratic opponents. But my goodness, I mean, when you listen to the people that some of the issues that they're embracing, free health care for illegal aliens, open borders, these are things that are not only losers in a general election, they're losers in a Democratic primary. And I, again, it goes back to my effort to leave Washington as much as I can. If you talk to, I know regular, normal Democrat voters, they don't like Donald Trump. They have good reasons for not liking Donald Trump. But none of these things appeal to them. They don't understand any of this. And it's why I think that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if I had to bet on 2020 right now, I would happily go all in for Trump again, because I just don't see how Democrats, you know, he has done so much to satisfy principled conservatives in the Republican Party. And the Democrats are not even offering a legitimate adult option.
Mm-hmm. Has he drained the swamp?
No.
Will he drain the swamp?
I think he'll do a better job of draining the swamp than anybody else would have.
What does draining the swamp mean to you, Charlie? Like, a lot of people have different definitions of this.
Well, I have a fairly dramatic definition of draining the swamp, and it involves shutting down maybe half of the cabinets. We don't need a Department of Labor. We don't need, and if you shut down the Department of Labor, literally it would be 3, 4, 5 years before the average voter, taxpayer in America would even realize that it happened. And they may never actually realize that it happened, except that the media would go absolutely bonkers.
Right.
There, I had these sort of these dreams of Donald Trump having a an apprentice style show in the Oval Office where he would invite each cabinet member in, and he would give them literally 3 minutes to explain the purpose of their department and why it is vital for American taxpayers to pay for it. And literally they would have 3 minutes. Then you would go, take 2 weeks, come back, and he would bring each one of them back in. And then he would fire them, mm-hmm. and we would shut down the department. And I would have absolutely no problem with that. And maybe some things get broken in the process, but so what? You could knock down all of these communist-style buildings up and down the mall, literally knock them down, and turn them into green space, which we like. Maybe, migratory bird habitat along the Potomac. It would be wonderful. And we could even say we could put hunting blinds in there. It would be marvelous. To me, that's draining the swamp. And I really do wish Donald Trump had more of that instinct.
What do you think his definition of draining the swamp is?
That's a great question. And I do believe there is no doubt in my mind that he wants to keep the promises that he made. And he is doing everything in his power. Now, we can question whether he's going about it the most sensible way, but he wants to build a wall along the border. He mm-hmm. wants to stop illegal immigration. He wants to make trade fairer for American workers. He does want all of those things. And I think that is more his definition of draining the swamp, because you think about it. I mean, they're lobbyists, and obviously lobbying is guaranteed by the First Amendment, and I think the ability to petition your government is a very important thing, and I think there should be fewer regulations on it than more regulations. Although I love the idea of having a ban on lawmakers. Have a 99-year ban on lawmakers going on to become lobbyists, but that's just me. But it is sort of amazing how the way special interests in this town that have a lot of money do seem to get a higher hearing than sort of the regular normal taxpayers,
right.
And because of that. I think that would be his version of draining the swamp. Is giving those taxpayers the first bite of the apple or the first seat at the table.
So for your book, you got access to Trump.
Mm-hmm.
How often?
He calls every now and then, I've been to visit a few times. I had lunch over there.
So sometimes you would schedule it out ahead of time, mm-hmm. and sometimes he would just call and.
Yeah. He's very gregarious. He's very funny. He's very engaging. And one of the things the first things that people misunderstood about Donald Trump is he's an Olympic listener. He listens so intently, and he thinks that everybody has some sort of perspective that is worth listening to, and he listens until he determines that you don't, and then it's all over with. But it's really interesting, and I'm always amused at these stories that come out about people talking about the outrageous questions that he asks. Like, I think soon after he was asking questions about the nuclear football, and he was asking very specific questions. And of course, this just horrified everybody in the media. They couldn't believe it. But of course, is there Is there any area that is more important for a president who's coming into the White House to ask about? Of course he's going to ask about all that stuff. And we saw it again, you know, that nonsensical story about using nuclear weapons to deter the hurricane or whatever. Who knows where these things come from? I think a lot of them are made up. But the confidence that it takes to sometimes ask stupid questions, that is, in my mind, is the sign of great leadership. Because you're admitting you don't know everything about it. The expert who's come into your office knows everything about it, or you trust them to. So you ask them every question you can, and then you make a decision. And the fact that style is so shocking to so many people in Washington, I think reveals how broken Washington is, right. and how literally, you'd want to go through the phone book and just pick somebody randomly out of the phone book and say, here, you do this job because you probably won't do it as bad as these people.
So take me through an interview with Donald Trump. You get, what, an hour of his time, let's say, in the White House?
It's a typical thing where it starts where you have 15 minutes, minutes. Mm-hmm. But he gets
on a roll.
On a roll, and there's no stopping him. And quite frankly, the last chapter of the book is him evaluating the 2020 prospects. Mm-hmm. And it's funny. I've done interviews, thousands and thousands of interviews, and I've interviewed presidents and interviewed all sorts of politicians, everything. The funny thing about doing an interview with Trump, and I've done other things for shorter term stories and things like that, I find myself doing transcribing the interview from a tape onto paper, and then you don't need to fill it with anything. You just put it out there completely unfiltered, and it's literally, if you went through the actual transcript and you went through that last chapter, it's basically a transcript of edited for length and maybe a little bit for clarity, but his stream of consciousness sort of riffing and talking about things, it's informative, it's interesting, it's hilarious, and maybe it rubs some people the wrong way. I happen to find it like his campaign rallies, just you can't turn away. And I mean that in a good way. It's just, it's so appealing. But it's, I've never covered anybody that has that quality to them where they can just go.
Right. You get an hour of Donald Trump's time. What's your advice to somebody who's going to go into a room with him for 30, 40 minutes and have a one-on-one? What are the do's and don'ts?
I guess it depends on what you're looking for. Obviously reporters have figured out that you can go in there and you can tee him up and you can basically sort of throw an insult his way that somebody else has leveled at him.
So-and-so said this about you.
Yeah.
What do you think?
And he's going to take the bait and go for it. I happen to find that really boring because that's not nearly as interesting as what he actually thinks about this problem or that problem. He has opinions, but it's like with the Boeing 737 MAX. Mm-hmm. He has an opinion about everything.
Right.
And it's all to varying degrees of, informed at varying degrees. And the more informed it is, the better I find, the better his opinion is. But, he made that comment after those plane crashes, and he said, these planes have become too automated. We need to hand the controls back to the pilots. Who has an opinion about something like that? And what politician has an opinion about something like that? Well, on something like that, I have not talked to him about that. I would be fascinated to talk to him about that and get him to just go on all the reasons. And he would go through a whole history of all these accidents that have happened and how many times, and he could talk to you about how many times the stories he knows where pilots, and of course he knows pilots, he loves pilots because they're doing awesome things. It would be fascinating. I find that sort of thing far more interesting than just teeing him up for a big Twitter fight between, Donald Trump and, somebody in Hollywood or something. It's just boring to me.
Yeah, it's worth noting, by the way, you and I are doing this shortly before 11 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast, and in what is a weird situation, I've come from the West Coast to the East Coast to talk to you. The President of the United States has gone from the East Coast to the West Coast. He's in California right now, and I'm probably keeping you for your work because he is up right now. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning in California. I'm sure he's tweeting away merrily on something.
I'm sure he is.
So I think it's easy to guess who has the best job in the White House besides the president, Charlie, and that's probably Ivanka.
Yeah.
That obviously the president adores her. I'm hard to see what she could do wrong and earn his wrath, and she has a very wide portfolio. She's sort of like the Obama aide, blanking on her name right now, was just sort of a minister without a portfolio. Ivanka's kind of that way, too. She has some things, but she can basically go wherever she wants to. Who has the worst job in the White House? It's easy to say the press secretary, the communications director, but they're not having briefings now. And, you know, if you look at what Stephanie Grisham is doing now, a lot of it's just responding to stories, which is pretty run-of-the-mill press 101 stuff. So
yeah.
Who do you think has a tough job on a day?
And I agree with you. I don't think the press secretary, I think that job has been the worst job in the past because people were trying to figure out how they were having to reinvent it.
Oh, I think if you had to go up in front of the press for an hour on national TV and just deal with that every day, that's a horrible job.
No, but I mean doing it in Trump's White House. At the beginning, it was horribly difficult because
the president's making the news, you're not.
Right. And not only it's a tough job under any circumstances, but it's a job. So you're going into to one of the toughest jobs there is, but then you're going into it, and oh, by the way, you're also completely reinventing it. So there's no I think Sarah Sanders. I think Sarah Sanders did a spectacular job of reinventing that, and did very well with it. And I think that Stephanie's doing a very good job.
Toughest job: security advisor, chief of staff. Who has the crap?
Oh, I would not. Well, there's a reason we don't have a chief of staff. That we have an acting chief of staff.
I should say. Yeah.
Yeah, but I would probably say the chief of staff job would definitely be the worst job, just because he makes those decisions himself, and he wants to make every decision himself, and he likes to. Both constructive ways and not constructive ways, he encourages people that work for him to fight it out and to argue things out. Part of it is that he benefits from it, from that friction. I think anybody benefits from hearing. I mean, it's why you have a Supreme Court sitting there with two lawyers arguing an issue out. But then I think there's also probably some streak to him that also enjoys the entertainment of it, which is probably not as constructive as the other part.
Well, let's talk about that, the managerial style. This seems to be an executive who likes to have his underlings fight with each other, be at war with each other. And there are two schools of thoughts. One school of thought is some executives just like to see turmoil beneath them. In part, it's just how they like to operate. The other school of thought, though, is it reflects a certain, shall we say, insecurity about yourself that you want to see others struggle.
Yeah. And I think that there's a mix of it, because obviously he likes to toy with things and toy with people that his opponents. One of his favorite things is talking about whether he can extend his second term in order to catch the FIFA football thing.
Yeah. Oh, wait, I miss this. He wants to.
It's 2025, and so he makes a joke saying, so maybe I'll have to extend my second term so I could still be president when we host the FIFA thing. Well, he does this frequently, where he makes a joke a lot of times on Twitter, where he puts up the campaign sign 2016 and then 2020 and then 2024 and then 2028, and it makes people go insane. I can assure you he's kidding. But he likes to play with people like this, and it is absolutely hysterical. Like when I had lunch with him over at the White House a couple of weeks ago, it was the day after, and actually I inscribed a copy of my book to him. I gave it to him and inscribed it to him as President Trump, the Chosen One. This was the day after he had made the remark about why no president before him had ever gone after China, I think it was. And he said he was standing there on the driveway when he was, somebody said, why is this gone on for so long if it's such a problem? And he said, well, because nobody's gone after him like I have. It's been a problem for previous presidents. And he said that he just looked up and he saw the clouds parting. And he said, I guess I'm just the chosen one. And he thought, he thought it was hysterical. He knew at that moment that they were going to just pillory him over it. And of course, what did they do? Completely took him seriously. Right. And I really love this because, you know, where I live, there are a lot of, I guess you'd call them Christian conservative types. And, you know, they're not offended by this stuff. They think it's hysterical. And yet all of these people who are shocked and outraged that he would refer to himself as the chosen one, do they actually care about the same issues that Christian conservatives care about? I don't think so.
Well, this gets back to the old line about those who take him literally but not seriously, and yeah. Those take him seriously but not literally. And here's what fascinates me about the media relationship with Trump, Charlie. First of all, I worked on the Bush Quail campaign back in 1992, and we did what every failing campaign in modern times has done. Blame the media, vote for Bush.
All right.
This is the sure sign of any campaign that's going down the tubes. Blame the media. Yes, it's what you throw out there. The Trump campaign, Charlie, may have been the first one in modern history where this worked. Blame the media, vote for Trump.
Isn't that interesting?
And he continues to go back to this well every time. People ask the question, why didn't he get along with the media? It's what brought him to the dance in the first place, bashing the media. What fascinates me is that this keeps working for him, and the media keep taking the bait. And every time he says something that says outlandish, they take him literally. And so they think, my goodness, he has a messiah complex. He talked about extending. He's extra constitutional. He's Mussolini. They keep running with this. And I think part of Trump knows this and does this on purpose because he knows it feeds the base by doing this. But here's the question, Charlie. It interests me. At some point, why doesn't Donald Trump let this go? Because if you think in part that he ran in 2016 to prove that the smart people weren't so smart they could actually win this, he's proven his point. He's right. Won the battle.
Right.
So why are you still fighting the battle 3+ years in?
All right, two things. One is I struggle with this question a lot about whether or not could you tweak the man so that he wouldn't get into all the fights that he gets into right. Or get wouldn't press every little button on Twitter that you know. And I've arrived at the conclusion that you got to take people for who they are. And yes, if he were tweakable, he would not be Donald Trump, and he would not be sort of the monster that he is in the swamp, ripping into people all the time. And so I think that's where I come down, is that, believe it or not, even I cringe sometimes, but I don't think there's anything you can do about it. Fascinating, your point about the 92 campaign, blame the media, vote for Bush. There are one of two things going on there. Either the problem with that, it could be that maybe the media just wasn't bad enough back then. I would argue that it was. The media has been, not...
I think the difference is simply this: the media did in George H.W. Bush, even though he's a very decent guy.
Absolutely.
The media clearly preferred Bill Clinton.
Absolutely.
So there's a bias built in, but in 1992 there was not the institutional distrust and dislike in the media that you have today.
Or that could be, but then the other alternative is blame Bush. Blame the media. Vote for Bush. Wasn't harsh enough. It wasn't mean enough. And what Donald Trump, the reason it works for Donald Trump is because he's so nasty about it. Right. And he's so personal about it. And he gets in their faces and he looks at them across the driveway and says, I'm not taking a question from you. You're fake news. And it's so mean that people at home say, my goodness, he really means this. He is not funning around.
Right. But if you're the Washington Post, Charlie, if you're the New York Times, if you're CNN, you know what's happened to this president? You're making money.
Oh, yeah.
Your ratings are up if you're CNN. If you're the New York Times, look at your subscription numbers. The same for the Washington Post. Hillary Clinton was elected in 2016. This is not happening. But I was thinking about this the other day, Charlie, what a different world it is if Hillary Clinton is president. And consider, for example, Jeffrey Epstein. So
yeah.
If Hillary Clinton is president, Charlie, I'd propose to you, the House is probably still Republican.
Definitely, right. Without a doubt.
So now you have a Republican Congress, and Jeffrey Epstein dies, and guess what? There are going to be Republicans calling for hearings on Epstein and Bill Clinton's role, and now we're kind of running down the whole usual Clinton swamp of sex and cutting corners and greed and making money on the cheap and so forth. We'd be living that kind of misery, but the media would not be profiting off of this.
That is so absolutely true. And even as the media, in so many ways, embarrasses itself with things that are just, you know, on the face of it, completely laughable. But it is true. And then the other thing is, you know, and again, you know, I can't stand stories like these because they're so destructive, and they're so they're just so stupid. But you know, all of this, the whole Mueller probe, the whole Russia thing. You know, at the end of the day, the reason people like me got into the news business in the first place is because I like to speak truth to power. I like to expose wrongdoing. I like to expose abuses of power. And at the end of the day, the only thing that the whole Russia thing revealed, and it was revealed very, very early, was that you had a sitting administration launched an intelligence operation, a spying operation, on political opponents at the height of a presidential election. That still happened. We know that happened. That is indisputable. And it is shocking to me that we don't have people as outraged about that as they should be. Every media outlet, there's no other story. It's worse than Watergate. It would be worse than the Pentagon Papers, except the Pentagon Papers were about something that was so much more important, and you were talking about lives at risk. Mm-hmm. If Hillary Clinton had been elected, none of that would have been revealed. And the fact that you have Republicans controlling one chamber of Congress and still haven't gotten to the bottom of how the previous administration pulled something like that off in a supposedly free country. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
How often do you do Fox News?
Several times a week. I come up here from home largely because of the studio. And
you said you're deep in the heart of Virginia. I went to Washington Lee, so it's about
3 hours. Okay, so so and WNL is a little bit west of where I am. I'm 2 hours south of Charlottesville in a little town called Chatham. A little crossroads called Tight Squeeze.
My best friend from high school's wife is from Chatham originally.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
It's a neat town. My parents live there. My brother.
That's a neat corner of Chatham and Appomattox. That whole corner of Virginia is really interesting. It's overlooked by a lot of people, actually.
Yeah, and it's you're right there, sort of in the foothills. So you go just a little bit west, right. In the western part of my county. You get into some actual kind of mountains. Yeah. And
still kind of the old South, because it's I grew up here in D.C., Charlie, and I remember getting on field trips to go to Manassas when I was a little boy, and you would go around the Capitol Beltway and turn off at Tyson's Corner, and the second you turn away from Tyson's and gone on Route 7, it was like being back in Mayberry, and just if there wasn't development, and the accents got very thick, and everything kind of slowed down. It was the old South, but you know, the South is sadly like my hairline; it's receding. And the South, I don't know where it's a great debate as to where the South begins. Maybe Fredericksburg, south of Richmond, I don't know. But you're still in a pocket, it sounds like, of the old South.
Oh, without a doubt. And you know, it's funny, you know, I grew up, pulling tobacco and, you know, arrowhead hunting, and some friends, we would go find old dumps. Yeah. And we would ride our bikes over there with trowels and dig through the dumps to find, you know, old coins and bottles, mainly looking for bottles. But it's my wife and I, we lived in D.C. on Capitol Hill up until probably 3 years ago, and it was really our boys got to a certain age where living in a city is just not. And now they get up every morning and they can go deer hunting, they can go fishing, they go work for the farmer next door. They can do all kinds of things like that, and it's a much better way to grow up, I think.
But Fox News, so you mentioned you do it a couple times a week.
Yeah, so I do it usually three or four between Fox and Fox Business. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it's a powerful outlet.
Right.
And especially when I look at the other cable news channels, there's no doubt in my mind why Fox is just the behemoth in that cable news race. Mm-hmm. And I thank goodness for that, for them allowing the diversity of voices that they allow on their channel. And if anyone doubts that there is a true diversity of voices on that channel, they're not watching and they're not looking at some of these other ones. And I always say to people, because I run into people around the country and they're like, oh, but that Juan Williams, he's so terrible. And I'm like, hey, you watch it. Juan Williams, first of all, Juan Williams is a wonderful guy, but more importantly, the thing that separates that viewer from some dodo who's watching MSNBC is the fact that Fox gives a full wide range of perspectives, and that makes that viewer, and I always tell that viewer, the reason you're an open-minded, sane person is because of Juan Williams, and thank goodness for Fox for doing that, because we need more of that in this country.
Why is the president tweeting against Fox?
I think he senses certain changes at Fox, mm-hmm. And he is obviously a consumer of media, and in particular, consumer of Fox. And I also think, quite frankly, some of it I think is strategic. It's interesting. When you look back at the first big fight he got into, the first big fight he got into was with the megastar of Fox News,
Megyn Kelly.
At that Cleveland debate, and he went out there and he got into a big fight with her, and it was very uncomfortable. And I know that for Roger Ailes, and there was, back and forth talking like, "What's going on here? This is crazy," and it sort of, but it helped Trump in a lot of ways. It meant that he wasn't, nobody was going to tell him what to do. He wasn't going to bow and scrape at any power. He was going to call things the way he saw them and have open air fights with people he felt like he ought to have open air fights with, and in a lot of ways, there's something very sort of liberating about it. There's something very honest about it, and the thing I like about Fox is it's very honest, and you have these scraps on with people, on air, and it's great, and they genuinely believe what I believe, why I got into the news business, which is airing our differences is a positive thing. And I think to some degree, Trump earned a lot of credibility mm-hmm. by doing that.
I wonder the last time the president walked through an airport.
It's so funny.
You know what I'm getting at.
Oh, I know exactly what you're getting at. Every time I go to an airport, it saddens me that Donald Trump doesn't have to go through the airport, because if Donald Trump had to go through the airport one time, you want to make American airports great again? He would be so horrified by the inefficiency, by the insulting treatment of passengers, of the people that are paying the bills, the assumption that everybody is a terrorist. He would be horrified by it. And these people touching, in the most inappropriate places, these people you've never seen before, they don't even buy you a drink, and they're rubbing all over you. He would be horrified, and he would abolish. And I love what the work TSA does, and don't be nice to TSA agents, because they're doing their job. God love them. But the idea that there isn't a better process, and that's the kind of thing, he would ask a lot of dumb questions like, why are we doing this? Why do we do this? Why don't we just, lock the cockpit and let everybody have guns? I don't care. He would come up with some innovative ways of sort of questioning how to get a better system. But the system is terrible. But it's so funny you say that, because I always think, every time I go to the airport, I wish Donald Trump had to fly commercial.
Right. Yeah, it's a great question, because he has his own airplane. God knows the last time he actually had walked through an airport. I thought about
saying, I promise you I will ask him that the next time.
Asking this, because I thought about the other night walking through SFO. I took a red eye to Washington from SFO. And this is everything that would just kill Donald Trump. The airport has a nice architectural design to it. It's very aesthetically pleasing from the outside. And then you get in the inside and you find fraying carpet. You find escalators that don't work, so older people who are carrying their bags have to walk really long distances.
He would be disgusted by that.
Disgusted by that. There are germs everywhere. Clearly, it hasn't been mopped down. But on top of that, Charlie, what's playing on TV? It's CNN.
Yeah, yeah. No, he would be absolutely disgusted by every bit of
it. It would be a circle of hell for Donald Trump,
right.
Basically.
And the idea that, wait a minute, this is America. We can make things better. There's something sort of communist about it, yeah. When you walk through those airports. It's just – it's so dreadful. And some of the small ones – like I'll fly out of Greensboro to go up to New York. Mm-hmm. And – Greensboro is the greatest airport on earth. It's small. It's clean.
This is the dirty secret of America. The nicest airports are small, yeah. Southern airports. If you go to Greenville, I fly in.
Yes, Greenville's wonderful.
Greenville, South Carolina, Charleston. I have family mm-hmm. in those two places. These are basically old World War II air bases. They now become airports. They're starting to take more traffic as their cities grow, but still they're small. It's a very short wait for luggage. People who work there are kind. They're happy yeah. to have their jobs. There's just not a surly bone there. It's actually a wonderful flying experience.
There's one exception, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the swamp. There's one exception. There's one big major metropolitan area that has a small town gem of an airport,
which is
Washington D.C.
Oh, National
Reagan National Airport mm-hmm. is a gem, and it's compact, it's neat, it's easy. It is literally from where we are right now, yeah. in the middle of traffic, it's probably 20 minutes from here. Yeah. And when there's no traffic, I would get from Capitol Hill to Reagan in 8 minutes mm-hmm. In the morning, like on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning. And it's clean. And, of course, the reason is because all of these politicians, all these government functionaries have to fly in and out every week, and they need a good – you know, they'd be horrified if they had to go to Dulles or BWI.
John McCain and, to really date myself, the Patricia Schroeder legacy. Pat Schroeder, the congresswoman from Denver back in the 70s and 80s, she wanted to fly nonstop to Denver from Washington.
That's right.
John McCain wanted to fly nonstop from Washington to Phoenix. Lo and behold, what does McCain do when he gets in the Senate in the mid-80s? We start playing fast and loose with the FAA rules. It's making life miserable for Dulles, by the way. But there's a warning sign about National. I flew in there the other day. I noticed they're building a new terminal
yeah.
driving out. So, like government, it might be growing too fast.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, the best thing about National is the original terminal.
Yes.
If you walk in those doors, it's just what you were talking about. It was an old government World War II airstrip. It's open. It's airy. It's a beautiful place.
Let's talk about what you're looking for with Trump in 2020. How the campaign differs from 2016.
Well, obviously, you're running as a barbarian storming the gate is obviously his style.
He's running on a record now.
Yeah. And so now it's a little bit different, but I really do think that and your question about has he drained the swamp? The fact that so many of the more commonsensical things that he wants to do like stopping illegal immigration at the border and all that sort of stuff. The fact that he is met with such resistance from every corner of Washington means that he can still sort of campaign on those things, and he will continue to campaign on them, right. and not dishonestly. It's not, I feel like a lot of times politicians in Washington, in both parties, tend to keep issues alive. They don't want to solve a problem because if you solve a problem, you can't run on it anymore. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of examples of that sort of thing. That it's maddening. Take an issue like late-term abortion. You could solve a problem like that you could just pick 10 people out of the phone book, and you could solve that problem to the 90% satisfaction of 90% of Americans in about an hour. And yet it never – something like that never gets resolved because everybody wants to campaign on that issue on both sides. And so – but I don't think that isn't what's going – I think Donald Trump – I've never seen a politician who is willing to spend as much political capital as Donald Trump does on actually accomplishing something. Mm-hmm. Usually politicians will only spend political capital on getting themselves reelected. Donald Trump doesn't do that. He'll focus on some issue, and he just won't let it go, and even if it requires him spending political capital. And so and that in and of itself is a very appealing thing to me about him.
This is the curious thing about the man not letting things go. For example, the Sharpie argument we got into over the hurricanes, he would not let that go.
And that's a good example where sane, intelligent people are like, what is he talking about? Yeah. Well, to me, you know, I think a lot of people who didn't pay attention to every, you know, minute by minute bit of that squabble, you know, if you just came to it afterwards and you realized that, okay, Donald Trump warned Alabama to be prepared for this hurricane. And in fact, at some point during the weather predictions, Alabama was clearly in the path. And there was this whole huge media squonk about it. At the end of the day, he ends up winning because he was right about that. And you know, I get it that that's probably not the best use of his time, but...
Well, but this is what's different about him, Charlie. I think traditionally presidents, how did presidents judge winning? Are they getting legislation passed? Are they, right. Do they have Rose Garden bill signing ceremonies?
Yeah.
And there are people who are out focus grouping in key states. So yeah. My numbers look good that I'm, in theory, winning. I'm not looking at the day-to-day media. I'm certainly not looking at the minute-by-minute of Twitter. But this president seems to look at the minute-by-minute Twitter, and so that's how he judges winning. He wants to win those battles. But yeah. The challenge with winning Twitter battles is Twitter battles go on forever.
Right. But and they are more than just Twitter battles. They are, because, I mean, Twitter is a special place of inanity. But there are... But there are, you know, like the thing about the crowd size thing. Mm-hmm. It still galls him.
Yes.
About the crowd size thing at the his inaugural,
right.
And I don't blame him actually. I used to sort of think, well, yeah, he should drop this, but I don't blame him actually, because to him, part of being president is the optics. Is part of being president is the show that you put on. Is the, you know, what am I trying to say? There's messaging, but it's like product placement. You know, it's product, it's selling. It's, you know, you've got to, the image has to be there. And this was an attack on the image of his presidency. And that bothers him. And when you step back and think about it, well, you know, it ought to bother him. And it's not unusual for politicians to get bothered by having their brand. It's a brand, is what I'm saying. If you're Levi's and your brand is attacked in a way that matters to you, damn straight you're going to fight for it. And that's what this guy does. And so I've sort of come around on that one, and I get why he. I think that sometimes I think maybe he should focus on other fights, but.
Right.
I do get why that's important to him, and I appreciate it. There's something very genuine about it.
Yeah, but, you know, this strikes me as what's curious about this period in history wherein Democrats have not accepted the results from 2016. There has to be a reason why Donald Trump is sitting in the White House. It is not legitimate. Either the Russians did something wrong, or votes weren't counted in Wisconsin or Michigan or Pennsylvania or something like that. In other words, Trump somehow had to cheat it or benefited from a rigged system to get in the Electoral College. Holy argument itself. But Trump, now correct me if I'm wrong here, but in fact, this is a question. Is Trump really different than he was in 2016? You've obviously spent a lot of time with him over the years. Has the man really changed that much from since he was running for office? In theory, the presidency should change you, not just in terms of hair or weight or anything like that. You should be a little different having had that job.
I think that he is better informed.
Mm-hmm.
He's a voracious learner.
Yeah.
He loves to learn things, and he loves to. That's what you know. When he asks questions, he really listens very carefully. That's a very important part of his sort of learning. So without a doubt, he has. But the other thing is, when he got elected, he was an experienced businessman who had enjoyed. Lots of success in a wide array of backgrounds. And in that respect, he isn't changed. He is definitely the same person. And he's unbowed by the sort of awesomeness of the job. He's not afraid of it. He's not intimidated by it. So in that respect, you're right. He isn't changed, but he is more informed and more. And I think that in some ways, I do think that he has done a is doing a better job of picking the fights that he fights.
Hey, ask him what he wants to do about a presidential library.
That's a great question. That's...
Ask him where he wants it to go.
Yeah.
Because you know there's going to be a huge fight over where it goes.
Oh, yeah.
My God, there was a fight at Stanford, of all places, over Ronald Reagan's library. So what city is going to want Donald Trump's presidential library?
Yeah, no, that's
what
good.
Should it look like?
So, yeah.
Kind of fun to play with. But let's get out of the conversation with a couple more questions. I'll let you go, Charlie. I sure appreciate your time. The idea of business as a family enterprise for the Trumps. You probably saw the Atlantic article, mm-hmm. which talks about the beginning of a Trump political empire. Like a lot of media, you read that story and it's not quite what the headline suggests. It just kind of talks about the various Trump children it doesn't talk about. You read the headline, it makes it sound like Donald Trump Jr. is Joseph B. Kennedy Jr. being groomed for things. It's right. not quite that. But you talk to Trump and you talk about his view on things. Clearly, Trump Enterprises is a family business.
Right.
You know, the sons are involved in it. The Apprentice was a family business in terms right. of the children being involved in it. But politics, do you think Trump wants his children to run for office?
Well, I know that I've talked to at least some of them who would never run for office, and I really believe them. You think about.
So there are three Trump. Well, there are four actually. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing three of them don't want to run, and I'm going to guess here.
Right. Yeah.
Not putting you on the spot. I'm going to guess first of all that the one in law school right now, Tiffany, she mm-hmm. doesn't want to. Actually, there are five children. I take this back. They're growing as we count.
Yeah.
Who knows what happens to the poor Baron, but so Tiffany, I assume Tiffany wants nothing to do with politics. Could be wrong, but maybe not. I'm guessing Eric doesn't want to run for office.
Yeah, when you look at
I'm guessing Ivanka doesn't want to run for office, but I could be wrong there.
I don't know about Ivanka, actually. She could surprise.
Yeah.
I think she could surprise us all. But if you think about the sort of the kind of unique thing that Trump has, In a lot of ways, I viewed that 2016 campaign as he was kind of running as a reality star candidate. And at the end of the day, voters trusted him to remain in that character more than they trust politicians to keep their promises. And I think it was a smart bet. And you look at the things, and going back to his various enterprises before getting into politics. I think all that experience was part of what made Trump so appealing to so many people is the fact that he did have all those varied experiences. And it didn't bother them that obviously being in the White House is, would be a burnishing of the Trump brand. Clearly that that's going to help any brand that shares the name with Trump. I think at the end of the day, all of that is largely, went into why voters felt comfortable with him and felt, politicians, you want to be trusted. You want to feel like you want voters to feel like they know who you are and where you're coming from. And Trump is, it's part of what Trump does. He is a, marketing, among other things, he's a marketing genius. Whether he's calling you some horrifying name, or he's, it's like the whole Trump Turnberry thing. I think part of him sort of finds that whole story sort of amusing, and he kind of likes it because he's sitting there going, Trump Turnberry, it's a good property. People are getting a lot of press off of that story, and I think part.
Yeah, I was curious about the children in this regard. I've been reading a lot of Kennedy stuff this summer, it seemed. Charlie, I read a really interesting book on John F. Kennedy Jr., read another book about the...
Was there anything that sparked your doing that?
Just Airplane Rides, Time to Kill, and also the JFK Jr. book was actually written by somebody who knew him,
uh-huh.
as opposed to some journalist just, kind of grasping at straws. This guy actually knew John Kennedy, was in his circle of friends, and so they all kind of gave him the story the way they wanted to remember it. I'm always fascinated with history as reported that way. And then the other book was on the Kennedy heirs, and these are the sons of Teddy and Bobby and Jack and kind of what happened to all of them. And two things come out of it. Number one, clearly the offspring of these three gentlemen are just not, they don't quite have what the old, mm-hmm. what their parents had. They just don't have that spark, that charm, the timing maybe, what have you. But secondly, the Kennedy view of the world is, even if you're not the most talented person, you still have to run for public office because that's what Kennedys do.
Right.
So that's why I was asking the question about Trump. And I'm kind of curious into Donald Trump's view as to what Trumps do. Do Trumps A, make money, to Trump's B, exist to draw attention to themselves and sell brands, or do Trump's now also run for public office?
I don't think that that is something that is certainly in his mind. But one of my favorite stories is about the early campaign when there were Republicans that were trying to come around to Trump earlier on and trying to help out, and they were trying to bring some normalcy to the early Trump campaign back when – this is when Corey Lewandowski was still campaign manager. And, you know, in our business, there in the news political business, there's a little thing called talking points, and campaigns often send out talking points every morning so that all of the quote-unquote surrogates who are going on TV or going around talking to reporters – are sort of on the same page talking about the same thing.
I've written these.
I know you have. So the Trump campaign decided that they would try to do some of these. And Donald Trump was interested in this. And so he would begin each one, instead of talking points, would start, Donald Trump is a builder. And the second talking point was, Donald Trump builds buildings. And then at some point they would get into talking about whatever the politics or news of the day was, but they always began, Donald Trump builds buildings. Donald Trump is a builder. And the people that have done campaigns before are laughing at this thing. This is ridiculous. This is not a talking point. Yes, it was. It was the only talking point that mattered to him, is that I've done things, I've built things you can see and you can touch, and they're great, and they're gold, and they have my name on it. And, you know, there's something universally appealing about that.
Right.
And it's why people would be stunned around here to find out the way Washington divides voters by race, gender, everything, and puts them all in these categories. Pollsters do it every time they do a poll. People around here would be shocked to know the different demographics that Trump appealed to in 2016. And I think will appeal again, but largely because of just that. Trump builds buildings. I build these great things that have my name on it, and I have a plane that has my name on it. And that was really gave people confidence that he was the real deal.
Okay, final question. Part of the draw for Trump in running in 2016, besides, I think, just the psychological thrill of just proving everybody wrong by saying I could win this, was also knowing that if he did get the Republican nomination, he'd run against Hillary. And who knows on what ways that just personally made him salivate running against her. But you talked to this president, and obviously running for re-election is to prove that it wasn't a fluke the first time, that he could actually do it a second time. I had held out this theory for a long time that he was going to be James K. Polk of the 21st century. Remember, Polk runs the one time, he makes a handful of promises, and come 1848, when it's time to run again, Democrats beg him to run. He says, I've done everything I set out to do. I'm out of here.
Right.
Drop the mic. And I thought, Trump could drop the mic too if he wanted to. But the more I thought it over, no, he has to prove that he can do it a second time. The one time's not a fluke. But here's the question, Charlie. In addition to proving that he can do this again, you know that he also relishes the personal level of the combat here. So he looks at that stage of Democrats, the other 10 candidates out there. He's looking at them. Who does he personally relish having as an opponent?
Because
normal politician Charlie, we can give the obligatory, it doesn't matter who I run against, it's just an honor to serve the American people, blah, blah, blah. No, part of him wants to have a very personal one-on-one with somebody. So who is it? Is it Biden? Is it Warren?
No, I don't think it's Biden.
Is it somebody we're missing?
I don't think that it's Biden, because as with a lot of people, it's kind of hard to hate Biden.
Yes.
You know, Biden is a, you know, avuncular, garrulous, you know.
And he's been through some pretty tough things in his life.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, he says incredibly stupid things. But you can't really hate the guy. And so I don't think it's Biden. But I think that, you know, Harvard train, you know, somebody like Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
Or Bernie Sanders, he would love to absolutely decimate them. But I will say this, Bill, that one of the things that I thought was interesting, because I asked him during that interview that's in the last chapter of my book, I asked him about why doesn't he just, you know, he's got a good life, why doesn't he just give it up and walk away? You know, you've accomplished this, it's great and everything, but the amount of grief that you get every day, and a lot of it dishonest, is just sort of amazing. And he said, because, he really does believe that he has been sent to on a mission to do something for people who have not been listened to by politicians and politics for a very long time, and he feels a real commitment to that. And I believe him. I don't think that he's a politician just saying those sorts of bromides. I think he really does feel a deep responsibility to get some of those things done for the people that voted for him.
Yeah, I think in terms of profiting off of Trump, I think of simple things like print reporters whose stories are suddenly on page one because of Trump. People who write books, Charlie Hurt, who have Trump in the title, because if you go to Amazon,
that's
it's
right.
The first role of publishers now, if you're going to write about something, put Trump in the headline because it draws attention.
Right.
Gonna miss him when he's gone, if he's gone soon.
Oh, I forget the marketing part of things. I'm gonna miss him because it's just gonna be so boring.
Exactly.
I'm gonna have to get a job. You know, I'm gonna quit the business. I don't want to go back to covering regular politicians.
Charlie Hurt, this was not boring. I sure appreciate the conversation.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this case, a book that examines the 45th President up close and personally. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. I also recommend that you sign up for Hoover's monthly Pod Blast, which gives you the best work of Area 45, Econ Talk, The Classicist, Strategica, The Pacific Century, Education Exchange. We have a lot of podcasts, in case you haven't noticed, Charlie, plus fellows' remarks from Hoover events. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover Fellows to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Charlie Hurt is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is, not surprisingly, @CharlesHurt, Hurt spelled H-U-R-T. And his book, Still Winning, Why America Went All In on Donald Trump and Why You Must Do It Again, yes, you can find it on Amazon. Anything else I need to plug while you're here?
No, and you can find it also at your local bookstore.
Still at bookstores?
Yes, there are still bookstores.
We made news.
Not just Amazon.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.